Good morning, everyone. Happy Yom Rishon, Shavua Tov. Thank you all for joining us on this Sunday morning. Fortunately, we can't be together, but at least we can be together virtually. Just before I begin, I'd like to thank Shari Shemayim for co-hosting this with us, albeit virtually, and to thank everyone for coming. And also, additionally, to note that this week we will be having what we're calling a Shavua Tone with Shari Shemayim. We can't do the regular Shabbaton, but we will be having many virtual opportunities to learn, specifically many of the topics, or the topics will be related to coronavirus, different ethical issues, and halachic issues dealing with the pandemic and how we should respond to it. There are details for that on the website, so if anyone's interested, you can let any of us know, and we'd love to join with you there. Okay, so today we have what we're calling Yom HaAtzmaut Learn-A-Thon 5780. Let me just introduce myself for those who don't know me. My name is Rabbi Sammy Bergman. I have the privilege of being the Sgan Rosh Beit Midrash, Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, here in Toronto. I say here in Toronto because I'm in Toronto. But thank you all of us for joining, for wherever you are. I want to actually give a shout out to my uncle, Uncle Baruch, who's with us here from Queens. So nice to hear from you. We're going to be talking today about the various Yomim Tovim, Moadim, that just passed, and the one that is upcoming, Yom HaAtzmaut, Yom HaRishalayim, Yom HaZikaron. And what I'd like to do is to talk about those from the context of Tanakh, and specifically Ezra and Nehemiah. The title of the shiur is called Ezra's Medina, the Challenge of Building a State. And so what I'd like to show is that many of the challenges, the issues that we face today in modern-day Israel are not new challenges. They're challenges that were faced, that the Jewish community faced even thousands of years ago. So before we get into the bulk of this year, I have this little table here. I think it's important to have some chronological context. I will note that this is sort of based on the traditional chronology, the way that Chazal saw it, and Rashi. As you can imagine, there is a lot of disparity between Chazal's telling of the events and their chronology and modern scholarship about the chronology. If you're interested in terms of how to gauge, bridge those gaps, there are all sorts of perspectives in the Acharonim and Rishonim, bridging from, look, Chazal weren't historians, they were teaching us lessons, to, if you disagree with Chazal, you are a heretic, and anything in between. But for now, just for simplicity's sake, we're going to deal with the chronology of Chazal. So take a look here at this table. It's significant to note the time period we're talking about. So, Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel, about 2,500 years ago or so, goes into Yerushalayim, destroys the Beis HaMikdash, and this actually happens in two stages, and it's worth noting both of them. So here, if you look in the first row of this table, it says in 3320, Melech Yehoyachin is exiled. First, Nebuchadnezzar comes into Yerushalayim, and he sends the King Yehoyachin into Galus, and then, about 18 years later, the final, I guess, straw in the exile takes place. King Tzidkiyahu is exiled, and the first temple is destroyed. Now, one reason this is significant is because the Jews have a promise from Jeremiah that their exile in Babel will be 70 years. It's going to be a 70-year exile. And the question, which actually causes some confusion, is when is this finally going to end, and how is this finally going to end? And that, with that, we begin the book of Ezra Nehemiah, and we begin in source number 2 with the very beginning of the Sefer, with actually King Cyrus's edict. Now, actually, rather, before we get to source number 2, if you take a look at source number 1 here, we have the following statement. This is from a book by Rabbi Chaim Jachter. It's called Reasons to Believe, which talks about many different things that can strengthen our belief in Torah and our belief in God. And one chapter he devotes to the miracle of the founding of the State of Israel. And one of the things he comments on is the unique role that President Harry S. Truman, the President of the United States in 1948, played in the founding of the state. I'm going to confess my ignorance. I am not sure who the Prime Minister of Canada was at the time that Israel was founded. I'm happy to hear about that. I'm also happy to hear about the providential role the Prime Minister of Canada played in the founding of the state of Israel. But for now, we're going to focus on President Truman. And he says as follows: much later in life, after being introduced to a Jewish group in 1953 as the one who contributed to the establishment of the State of Israel, Truman protested that he did not merely assist in its creation, but rather he felt truly responsible for the Jewish state. I am Cyrus, he proclaimed. So way to go, Truman, for taking all the credit. What is it? Why was he calling himself Cyrus, and who was Cyrus? So if you look at source number two, this is the beginning of Ezra, and I actually would like to think about this. Imagine you were a citizen in the kingdom of Persia, a Jewish citizen at the time. And here's how the story begins. So in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, we'll use JPS's translation. At the end of the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord roused the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia to issue a proclamation throughout his realm by word of mouth and in writing as follows. Now, you read this sentence, and there are a few things that are striking. First of all, and if anyone is willing to participate, I love participation, so please feel free. I guess everybody, Torchiner can unmute anyone. So if you're a Jew and you're in Persia, what are you waiting for right now, right? You're in exile. You're stuck in another kingdom. You were kicked out of your homeland. What are you waiting for before you come back? Or what kind of thing are you looking for? And apparently everyone can mute themselves also. So if anyone has any thoughts. Right? What kind of thing are you waiting for before, you know, you're like, okay, now it's time to return to Israel?
They certainly weren't waiting to come back, because when they had the opportunity, only 42,000 did.
Okay, so we'll get to that. So they're not waiting to come back. Well, why not? Why wouldn't you be waiting to come back?
They had three chariot garages and they were comfortable.
They're comfortable. Okay. I have your economic security. Okay. So a very fair criticism is the Jewish community in Babylon and Persia were comfortable. They didn't want to come back. But what about the following, right? If you were to think of the person who is going to inspire this new community, this return to Jerusalem, what kind of person would that be? Who would you think? Who are we used to? Who's going to be our leader in developing this new Jewish state? So if you look at the beginning of Ezra, it's fascinating that the person who dominates the beginning of the story is actually a foreign king. It's Cyrus, king of Persia. And the language in this first pasuk we just read is shocking. It says, God awakened the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia. God awakened his spirit. You know, we don't usually talk about foreign kings in that way. When you think of God awakening someone's spirit, what type of experience is that usually? What do you think of? God awakened someone's spirit. Prophetic, nevuah, exactly. It's some sort of spiritual experience, some spiritual encounter with God, and Kodesh is being described in this way. And that's really fascinating. And this is how the book of Ezra begins. And it continues. Let's take a look back at source number two. Ko Amar, this is in the second pasuk, the second verse. I'll read it in English. Thus said King Cyrus of Persia, the Lord God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and has charged me with building him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. And you read this verse, and you said, God charged you with building him a house in Jerusalem? You're the king of Persia. What is it your business to build a house in Jerusalem? But that's what Cyrus says. Any one of you of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, that is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord, God of Israel, that God that is in Jerusalem. So Cyrus, right, this foreign king, is inspiring or trying to gather the people of the Jewish community and send them to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. Now, tell me if you disagree. If I were a Jew and I was in Persia and I heard King Cyrus wants me to go to Jerusalem and build the temple, I don't know what I would think. King Cyrus is telling, what? Could this be what God was planning? Really? This is how we're going to come back? This is the redemption we're waiting for? And yet, that is how the story begins. So it's actually fascinating. Now, the truth is that the response of the Jewish people is not necessarily so great, as we'll see. It's not that so many of them are actually awakened to go back to Israel, but I think we can understand that, right? The fact that it's a foreign king dictating them and telling them to go do it must have been quite confusing. Furthermore, it says here that Cyrus was awakened by God. What does it mean that he was awakened by God? We're told that he's awakened by God, right? Did they know that he was awakened by God? Did the Jews know that this was some experience? If you look at source number 3, just briefly, the Ralbag says that, well, what does it mean he was awakened by God? It seems that God showed this idea to Cyrus in a dream in which he commanded him to build him a house in Jerusalem. So says the Ralbag, Cyrus must have had some sort of dream. And that's how we know he was awakened by God. But did the Jews know that? Did they know about Cyrus's dream? Now, they might have had a reason to suspect this, but you can understand sort of the ambivalence toward this command. Now, to me, this also rings true today in terms of the following. When we think of Israel and the challenges we face as in developing the nation of Israel, so I think one of the things that we face is the problem of foreign aid, meaning so much of Israel's success is highly contingent upon us getting assistance from other countries. For instance, the United States donates billions of dollars to Israel annually. Iron Dome, the defense mechanism, which is so integral in the safety in the communities in Israel, is funded primarily from foreign sources. And sometimes this gets us into a bit of a difficulty. We're relying on other governments to found and protect our state. And how are we supposed to deal with that? Is that the way it's supposed to be, or we're supposed to be reliant on other countries? And that's a challenging question, but the truth is, that's the way it was in the time of Ezra as well. So this is a challenge. But the truth is, God, in another place, actually makes it clear that this is the way I want it. Take a look at source number 5. If you have the source sheet. I saw a message that someone didn't get the source sheet. You should have the screen being shared. Rabbi Tortina, if you don't mind just sharing it maybe one more time. But this is a parak from Isaiah. And look how God refers to Cyrus. Says the Pasuk in Isaiah 45, and I'll read it in English. Thus said the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed one, whose right hand he has grasped, treading down nations before him, ungirding the loins of kings, opening doors before him, and letting no gate stay shut. How does Hashem refer to Cyrus? It says, Lemishicho, his anointed one. Right? The word Mishicho, that's the word Mashiach. God is calling Koresh a Mashiach. Now, it doesn't mean the ultimate savior of the Jewish people, but it certainly is quite provocative that he's calling him Mashiach in this Nevuah. That Cyrus is meant to be seen as a messenger of God. And I think one message that we see from this is that we don't always know the type of messenger that God will send to bring redemption. We'd like it to be some sort of righteous Jewish leader akin to a King David or a an ultimate Mashiach. That's how we sometimes imagine things, but maybe that's not always the way that it happens. God says Cyrus is the Mashiach here. And actually, if you look at the continuation, I think in this parak in Isaiah, I think it's also very relevant. So God, it talks about how God has ultimate power and he can essentially do what he wants. And if you look at the very end of it, the last two verses, from the words Laman Yigdu in Hebrew, in English, and it was from the word so that they may know from east to west that there is none but me. I am the Lord and there is none else. I form light and create darkness. I make weal and create woe. I, the Lord, do all these things. The term Ani Yotzer Or Varei Choshech, right? The creator of light and darkness, which we say every day. Oseh Shalom Uvoei Ra, creating peace and evil. This idea that God is the source of everything. God is the source of what we see as evil. God is the source of what we see as good. And I think the message here is, look, things that happen in the world, the important things that happen to us as a nation, they come from God. And whether we see it as good or whether we see it as evil, we have to realize that things might not be the way we think they would be, but that doesn't mean that they don't come from God. God is the source of all of these things. And that's part of the important message here. So while we reckon with the challenge of dealing with foreign nations, dealing with foreign governments, the advocacy that we often invest so much of our time and energy in, this is also just part, has been part of, historically, starting a Jewish state. And that's the first point I want to make. Now, if you look in the next source, the fact that the Israel, the Jewish state, started in such a unexpected way actually results in a lot of confusion. So here we're looking at, in source number 6, Ezra chapter 3, and here what happens was, after Cyrus issues his edict, the people, the community of Israel, are very inspired, and they, and some of them gather a group of people. There are thousands of people that go, about 50,000 or so, go to Israel, not with Ezra yet, and they get to Jerusalem, and here's what happens. Vayishma Yeshua uvanav, okay, we're in source 6. I'll read the English. Yeshua, his sons and brothers, Kadmiel, and his sons of Judah, together were appointed in charge of those who do the work in the house of God. Okay, also the sons of Henadad, their sons and brothers, Levites. When the builders had laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, priests in their vestments with trumpets, and Levites, sons of Asaph, with cymbals, were stationed to give praise to the Lord. So what happens here is they lay the foundation for the Beit HaMikdash. They lay the foundation for the second temple. Now, that's a pretty significant event. This is a big deal. The second Beit HaMikdash, the foundation has been laid. So you can imagine that the response should be celebration, instruments, praising God. And that's the first thing we see here. They sing song extolling and praising the Lord, for he is good. His steadfast love for Israel is eternal. All the people raised a great shout extolling the Lord because the foundation of the house of the Lord had been laid. And this is all very expected. But then the pasuk continues. The verse continues as follows. Many of the priests and Levites and the chiefs of the clans, the old men who had seen the first house, wept loudly at the sight of the founding of this house. So people were crying. So there's praise going on, there's singing, there's joy, there's celebration, and there's also crying at the same time. Many others shouted joyously at the top of their voices. The people cannot distinguish the shouts of joy from the people's weeping. For the people raised a great shout, the sound of which could be heard from afar. So what we have here is an incredibly poignant scene. We have an event that probably has been awaited for decades. We're waiting for the Beit HaMikdash to be rebuilt. They lay the foundation, and what's the response? It's a mixed response. There's joy, there's celebration, but the people who witnessed the first temple are sad and they're crying. Now, on a simple level, and I'm going to ask for a bit of participation here, why are they crying? Why are they crying upon laying the foundation of the second temple? What is so sad about it? Sorry? Crying of happiness, you're saying. Chaim. Okay, that's one way of looking at it. Crying of happiness. Bochim b'kol gadol. Why does it mention they saw the first one? Okay, that's one way of taking it. What do you make of the fact that this confusion at the end? Shana says it's a shame that Israel couldn't do it. And I think that's one way of taking this is people are really just confused as what they should think. The idea of people didn't know what the cries were. Is it laughing? Is it crying? There's trumpeting. Are we celebrating? Are we mourning? No one really knows. People are very confused. And it is confusing. We're back in Jerusalem, but it's not everyone. As the Talmud tells us, it's a fraction of the Jewish community actually returned. They're founded by a foreign government. They don't have that much money. This is not the redemption they were looking for. And on a simple level, it wasn't nearly. The construction takes much, much less than the construction of the first temple. It's a shadow of what it used to be. So people actually don't know what to think. Now, to me, this also really relates to the situation at the beginning of the founding of the State of Israel. Meaning, on the one hand, we celebrate the founding of the state and think we give thanks to God. We're so appreciative of the blessings that God gave to us. But we also acknowledge that when the state was founded, it certainly wasn't a simple matter, right? What happens when independence is declared? As there are wars. There's lots of complications involved. There's politics involved. There's dealing with surrounding nations that attack us. There is religious upheaval. There is religious conflict. Should we be a religious state? Should we not be a religious state? How do we navigate all these issues? It's confusing and complicated. And as we'll see, the idea that there's no that the leader of this movement is not some righteous servant of God. It seems to be led by many people who have distanced themselves from traditional religion. And how do we view all of that? And that's part of the confusion that people at the time were feeling. And as Shana noted in this text over here, a shame that Israel couldn't do it. If you look at source 7, this is what the Malbim says. It's not just, the confusion doesn't just come from the fact that it's not the most impressive physical structure. It also comes from the fact that this is not the way they envision it. This isn't what redemption is supposed to look like. Redemption isn't supposed to be a few thousand Jews march forth from Persia and Babylon and cobble together some resources from the king and build a house. This is supposed to be miracles. There's supposed to be armies. There's supposed to be a great triumphant return to Jerusalem. And they're confused about that. And that's really part of the message of Ezra is that redemption can really come in many different forms. Now, the next thing I'd like to talk about and discuss, and another theme that comes up a lot in Ezra, is the idea of politics and dealing with foreign nations that may have, or often do have, differing goals. And if you look in Ezra, the nations surrounding Israel, or the Jewish people in Jerusalem, were very opposed to the building of this new structure. There was a lot of opposition to the building of the temple, so much so that Ezra tells us in Perek, or the Navi tells us in chapter 4 and chapter 5, that the temple, although the foundation was laid, the construction is halted, it stops. People tell the king of Persia that he should stop the construction, because if you let the Jews build the temple, they'll revolt, they won't pay taxes, and for years, the foundation is laid, but the temple actually never gets constructed for years. Till finally in chapter 6, we're told that Haggai the prophet and Zechariah, and this is also discussed in their Nevi'im, in Haggai and Zechariah, have a Nevuah, and they inspire people, the Jewish people in Jerusalem, to actually continue with construction of the temple, even though there is no edict from the king of Persia to continue that construction, even though he had ordered it to be halted. And what's fascinating is, and actually incredible, is the response they give. So if you look here in source number 8, it describes how a number of people from the surrounding nations see the Jews rebuilding the temple, and they aren't happy about it. Take a look here at the words at once. At once, Tatnai, governor of the province of beyond the river, And this is, I only have the English here because the Aramaic is very difficult to translate. Shedr Botznai and their colleagues descended upon them and said this to them: who issued orders to you to rebuild this house and clean its furnishing? Who says that you can rebuild the temple? Then we said to them, we being the Jewish people, what are the names of the men who are engaged in the building? But God, sorry, actually, this is when we say we, so the governor goes to the Jewish community and says, who says you can build this and what are your names? Now, when the people in Jerusalem are asking for your names and saying, why are you disobeying the king? They're probably not getting your names to put you on, you know, the honor roll, right? It's very risky to give your names in this context. They're saying you're rebelling against the king. He said to stop building the temple and look at what you're doing. But look at the way that they respond. But God watched over the elders of the Jews, and they were not stopped while a report went to Darius, and a letter was sent back to reply to it. This is the text of the letter that Tatnai, governor of the province of Beyond the River, and Shesar Botznai and his colleagues, the officials of Beyond the River, Aver Anar, sent to King Darius. So they sent a letter back to Daryavish saying, look, the Jews are building the temple. They sent a message to him, and this is what was written in it. To King Darius, greetings and so forth. Be it known to the king that we went to the province of Judah, to the house of the great God. It is being rebuilt of hewn stone, and the wood is being laid in the walls. The work is being done with dispatch and is going well. Thereupon we directed this question to the elders. Who issued orders to you to rebuild this house and to complete its furnishings? We also asked their names so we could write down their names or leader for your information. And this is what they answered. We are the servants of God, of heaven and earth. We are rebuilding the house that was originally built many years ago. A great king of Israel built it and completed it. But because our fathers angered the God of heaven, he handed them over to Nebuchadnezzar, the Chaldean king of Babylon, who demolished this house and exiled the people to Babylon. So picture this scene. You're stopped. You're building this temple. These foreign nations come to you and stop you. They say, we're going to tell the king and give us your names. And what do you respond? Look, we're servants of God. God inspired us to do this. And that's why we're doing it. And then they go on, and it's important to know that they say, and King Cyrus also originally said we could do this, and they say you could look, there's a letter. But it's fascinating that in dealing with foreign nations, in dealing with an opposition, potentially to a foreign king, they stand by their principles and say, God commanded us to do this. Another note quickly, I know we're running out of time, but this idea of invoking God in dealing with foreign kings and dealing with foreign governments in our politics, involving God in our politics, is a theme in Ezra and Nehemiah, the following book as well. Now here, Nehemiah is in Persia, and he is a servant of the king, and he hears about what's happening in Jerusalem, he hears the cities in ruins, and he wants to go back. Now, I just want to note this quickly. The king sees that he's very upset, and he says as follows: Yom HaMelech, Amazatam Vakesh, Vespalel Elokea Shemayim. The king says to Nehemiah, well, what do you want? Why are you sad, and what do you want from me so that I can help you? And what does he do in the middle of this conversation? He davens to God. And then he asks the king for his request to allow him to return to Jerusalem and help strengthen the community there. Again, this idea, mid-conversation with a foreign king, I don't know how it worked. Did he, like, do this in his head? Did he mutter a quick prayer? I don't know. It's quite gutsy, if you ask me. Imagine talking to a foreign king and praying in the middle. But he invokes God in this conversation. And I think part of the idea is the politics involved with founding the Jewish state is not just a political situation. It's not simply a question of policy. It's a divine religious question that we view our politics as a religious endeavor. And we have to involve God in it and pray to God and stand by our religious principles. So I just want to close quickly. If you look at source number 10, the Navi just mentions how part of the idea of Ezra was not just to bring and found the state, but to cause a religious revival. And he reads the Torah publicly. He reads it publicly so everyone can understand, men, women, and children, both people who knew the Torah and people who don't know the Torah. And part of, a big part of the story of Ezra and Nehemiah is also the religious challenges, not just political ones. There were people who were not observing religion, who were not keeping Shabbos, who were intermarrying. All these things are happening, and this is part of the founding of the state. And while many who originally opposed the state of Israel were worried about the religious, the lack of religiosity of some of the Jews who went back to Israel, people who were not observing religion traditionally, but this is also something that happened historically. And so I just want to end with source number 11 very quickly. This is from the Netziv in Kovetz Shivat Zion, which was a book, or a rather something written as the Aliyah movement was happening in the late 1800s. And here's what he says. And as it was in the days of Ezra the scribe, who gathered together a few thousand people in Babylon, of all types of people, great Torah scholars and those who fear God, and also of men who had married foreign women, who were accustomed to violating the Sabbath and did not know the Torah at all. All these assembled and prepared to return to Eretz Israel, until afterwards the country became full of its children. So we must awaken to the voice of God's which is heard from the end of the world to the other, and among all types of Jews. Point being that yes, there are challenges in founding the state of Israel. Yes, it's not simple. There are political challenges. We rely on foreign nations. We require foreign aid. There are religious challenges. It's hard to see where exactly God's hand fits into all of this. But also we know that redemption comes in many forms, salvation comes in many forms, and it's upon us to deal with the state of Israel as best as we can. And although, despite all the difficulty, thank God and count our blessings and engage in hopefully this new redemption. So I'm going to give it over to Alex. Thank you all for listening. And have a wonderful day.